And so the so I have the deal all cut. It would take $1 million to fund it, plus $1 million to you know, as working capital and so forth to expand it. And we had a handshake. I call head office, all excited, and they tell me they're going to have to build a big new chemical plant. And so I was pissed off, to be honest with you, but because I worked so hard in getting these deals, and I went back to them and said, look, we don't have any capital, but we'll put our technology in. You put the capital up, we'll put the technology in. Well, they were kind of insulted, and so that deal failed many, many years later, just almost 40 years later. I did do a deal in Italy where we did acquire a major thing, but this time we had to bring our own capital. And in the meantime, Union Carbide picked up this other company, and that's their company in Italy. And so,
when did the cartel start really paying attention to you?
Well, it took the British quite a while. I went through about 10 managing directors while I was there. They think the problem was their managing directors, not their marketing policies. You know, it's like competing with a public utility company. A monopoly just doesn't know how to compete because they're so used to taking orders. I was on the phone this morning with AT&T, and the girls are very pleasant. And I'm telling them, look, I'm paying 20 cents a minute, and I think that's too much, and I'm doing all these calls to this one area. Don't you have a wide area network that, you know, well, you're on our lowest rate, and we don't have any other rates, and why don't you try the business department? So they give me a, can I transfer it? You know, they're very pleasant, but they're not solving my problem because I think I'm paying too much for all these calls going back to Pennsylvania. And the same thing with British Oxygen. You know, they had their rules and their regulations, and that's the way they do business. And the fact that Air Products would come in there and would put caps on the cylinders, would have a tailgate that didn't smash the concrete on the customer's deck when we put the cylinder down. I mean, just little things that were customer-focused, customer-oriented. And we had built that philosophy very early on. We were small, we were competing them with these large giants, and we knew that we just had to give better service. And we did, and so we won our share of new customers. But there is just tremendous opportunities when you're competing with monopoly to become customer focus and dig in and find out what customer needs are and respond to those needs and develop, you know, engineering alternatives and different technical solutions. And I think that, you know, those companies that do that really do grow for you. I mean, you know, clearly we have built today a $4.5 billion business, literally out of thin air. I mean, it's not just a catchy title. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what we did. Mm-hmm. We had no raw material position. We had no technology position going in. All we had was a group of entrepreneurial people with forward-looking ideas and a concept that if we could figure out ways of getting the price of the industrial gases down and focus on new markets, not just competing to serve existing customers where you had to battle to take them away, although we weren't opposed to doing that either, but offering, you know, cost advantages, we believe that we could make the market grow. And that's what happened. When we started out in the United States, we used to throw all the nitrogen away. Well, Air Products said, well, gee whiz, why do we want to do that? I mean, there's four times as much nitrogen as oxygen. Let's focus on markets for nitrogen, because carbide was so oriented to the metals industry and selling oxygen for processing steel that all the nitrogen. So we said, well, all right, let's go after that. So we looked at electronics and looked at food. We looked at blanketing, shielding, purging. Today we sell 3.5 times as much nitrogen as we do oxygen. Mm. Now stoichiometrically, 4 to 1. We need a little bit of it for internal processing. But the point is, if you focus on what we thought was the obvious, but others had just focused on one aspect, you can. And of course, as a result of that, our costs were lower, because if we can take 4.5 parts of the gas we process and find markets for it, I can only take 1 out of 5 parts, well, we're going to have much lower unit costs. It's like selling all the chlorine and all the caustic and all the hydrogen out of a chlorine cell when somebody else can only sell the chlorine and has to give the caustic away. We did that.
As you were developing in Europe, the people you were hiring, the bright engineers, were they Americans or were they local?
Mostly locals. I don't think at any time we had more than maybe 10 Americans in residence there. And we just took the... First, they were expensive to send over. you had to provide housing and schooling and overseas compensation and all those things, none of which I got when I went, but that came later. What we really wanted to do was we wanted the brightest and best. And then language is a problem on the continent, so we wanted people that knew the culture, knew the language. And it took a while. We made some mistakes, because if you don't know the language, you don't know the nuances, you don't always able to interpret what the person's saying and whether they really have what it takes. But the other thing that we concluded is that if we wanted to mold an organization to be really entrepreneurial, we really didn't want to hire people from our competitors, because then we would have to change all of the things that they had grown up to. I mean, it would be nice to have some of their knowledge about specific customers, but what we really wanted was an entrepreneurial organization who would work for long hours for low pay, and we couldn't afford big salaries either. But as a consequence, we think we really built the company around a lot of strong people. I mean, the vice president of engineering came out of Britain, the head of our sales for electronics came out of Britain. We have some of our top technologists from Germany and France today, and now we're bringing Oriental people in. And so by going for the brightest and the best and then teaching them what they have to know about our business turned out to be a much better strategy. Now, in a few key areas like finance, where we need good, solid, experienced people who had a reputation and could breed confidence, controllers, tax people, lawyers, there you were buying experience, not just raw entrepreneurial spirit. And so we had a blend of that. But in the main, the managers that we hired at the beginning are the ones that are running the companies today. Ron Sullum, who runs all of Southern Europe for us, was a CDP graduate from Leeds University. Al Bull was a young sales engineer with a German chemical company. Dave Moran, we hired out of Imperial College. The guy that we just sent to Hong Kong, Jeff Proctor, came from CDP, from one of the Welsh universities. And you can go right through the whole organization, finance, engineering, marketing, and so forth. And it's a pattern that we did in the United States, too. Hire the brightest and the best, do it every year, good years and bad, build a cadre, build depth. Our competitors today are struggling. British Oxygen, had to hire somebody that was a top executive in Air Products to try to bail them out, because they just never had done their homework in building layer upon layer of bright, young, capable people who would then matriculate up to the top. people that wanted us out of the sales engineer to become chairman of the board. And, you know, it's an obvious strategy today, you know, succession planning and development, but Air Products focused on it almost from the beginning, which is with all the other things you have to do, and it's amazing. We believe in diversified experience. Sending me to Europe at age 29 with a freshly minted MBA degree was a great thing for me, but it was a great thing for the company too, because I developed experiences and knowledge and diversified work practices that nobody else in the company had. And so I was able to add a dimension to the company, and of course international is now one of our major thrusts, as it is the major thrust of the chemical industry today.
I was going to ask if, well, I mean, those, first of all, those must have been pretty heady times for you, being that young and having all this opportunity and laying there in your for you to work with.
At the time, I didn't perceive it to be opportunity, but a whole bunch of problems. But
Did you have any interactions with your counterparts in other American companies who were also expanding in Europe at that
time? A few, yes, and that was helpful. I mean, it was a little easier to sell to DuPont or to Ford Motor or General Motors because we had a bit of a reputation in the United States, so we weren't a total stranger, and I didn't have to, you know, with a British customer or a Belgian customer, you had to go back to, you know, have this kind of a dialogue as how you got here and are you going to stay? I mean, if we sign a 15-year contract, are you going to be here 15 years from now? Because, you know, they looked around at us and versus the safe decision would be to go with a solid, true blue guy. But, you know, and we didn't win every order, and there were those that were more nationalistic inclined or those that were somewhat risk averse. We did make a point that they had a stake in fostering competition, that they weren't prepared to back us. Clearly, we would not be here in the long term, but if they were prepared to back us, we had a long-term future.
Hi.
So it went well, and you know we grew on the continent, developed businesses in Belgium and the Netherlands, France. We did a lot of exporting to Spain, Germany, and we competed with our principal worldwide competitors in their home market, and that's an important thing to do, because if you want to test yourself against your toughest competition, compete with them at home. Mm-hmm. They're relatively weaker abroad, and so to beat up on them in the United States is not nearly as challenging, or do you have to be as good as competing with them in their own backyard, where they have much more strength and capability and relationships. And so if you can win there, you can win anywhere. You know, the song says, you know, if I can do it in New York, I can do it anywhere. If you can do it in France, you can do it. Or do it in Tokyo, you can do it any place. And so that's what we did. And we strengthened ourselves because we learned what it took to win at the highest level. We organized how to win at the highest level. We hired the right kind of people to succeed. And if you needed better, more creative, more technically competent, more entrepreneurial people to win, those same characteristics served you well. The other thing about being an international company is that every market, as we learn about the power thing, is not the same. But the experiences that you gain in one market are translatable. And so it strengthens a company to participate in many markets around the world. And then flow those experiences back and then distribute them back out to your network. And the companies that are in the world marketplaces competing to different degrees of applications, different uses of products, different end market requirements, they develop that knowledge and then they can introduce it around the world. And so those companies that only focus on the United States I think, suffer because there's a big world out there with a lot of things going on. And if you're not interacting with those things, you're going to get left behind. That is the lesson of the American steel industry. They never went abroad. And so they never knew what was happening in Japan and in Europe and in Australia, Austria. And those technology developments driven by different sets of economics that existed then in those markets, but ultimately existed in the United States, were driving technological changes that just eroded. I mean, we were putting in open hearth furnaces when Europe was building LD steel plants. And, you know, it was taking 5 hours to do a heat that they were doing in 30 minutes. But we weren't interacting. We weren't competing. We weren't there. We weren't on the ground floor. The United States was rather smart to get Wernher von Braun's scientists to come over here because we didn't know about that rocketry that was going on. And so that was one of the things that I was able to do, is to change the horizon, the breadth of the company, and create a cadre of people with different education, different cultural experiences, and then to help to blend that into our American experience. And in the course, in the process of doing that, I think we became a stronger company with better visions. And Union Carbide never did do it until real late. And then, of course, we were introducing new products and technologies that in the United States market they knew nothing about. And then, of course, they started to scramble to try to play catch-up, but they lost the momentum. And
you came back from Europe
in
67?
67, yeah. We were there 10 years.
When you came back, did you feel you had accomplished your one-page list you wrote down?
No. Not really. We hadn't gotten the full market share, but we certainly had put in place the things we needed. We put the people, the plants, we were on the continent, and we were the only company who was operating in all of those different markets. And so it's been said that the American companies did a better job of taking advantage of the common market of Europe than the Europeans did, because we went across those borders because we didn't have those cultural barriers that existed. And because we were a stranger wherever we went. So, you know, being a stranger in Paris was no different than being a stranger in Germany. We just had to do the things. Whereas it was difficult for the French to think in terms of competing in Britain or competing in Germany. I mean, they just didn't do those things. Whereas, the Americans said, well... And so we would build plants on the border of Belgium and send one pipeline into Holland and one into Belgium. We'd build a plant on the border of France and send it into Germany. And, you know, the borders didn't mean anything to us. And the distances were so much shorter than the distance in the United States that geography wasn't a barrier to, you know, thinking in global terms. Now, I presume there were some people that, you know, thought on a countrywide basis, but we did. We looked at the whole market and tried to build plants that were as large as possible and thereby as low cost as possible to serve the largest market that could be, you know, economically served from a single point.
Why did you come back? What
precisely? Well, I had felt that I had accomplished primarily the goals I wanted to do. Ed Donnelly was moving up in the organization as president, and I thought that now was the right time to get in there and become the executive vice president.
Which was a new position, wasn't it?
Well, I think Ed had enjoyed that position too.
But relatively new.
Yeah. And it was an opportunity to run... all of our gas businesses worldwide. Yeah, I was probably the first one to run all gas business because I would, alternatively, one week I would report to Ed, another week report to Leonard, and then to George, and depending upon what was hot at home. And so I came back and and really turned Europe over to a British successor. And then we had some problems in Germany. I had to go back and fix those and get new management in place. And then in the United States, we started to focus on a more market-oriented type approach, by products and markets. And we created a medical division, and we created an international division. We created a...
isn't there a welding division?
Yeah,
that
welding
started?
And medical, yeah. And ultimately, we made some initiatives, but we really never was able to get to a critical mass. And it was partly done as a diversification effort, and the core businesses continued to grow so rapidly that we really didn't succeed very well in those things, and ultimately merged them back in. But we continued to push on the international growth. We went to Canada, went to Mexico, started the Far East, went to Japan, and through a whole series of joint venture acquisitions throughout the Pacific. And so today we're probably in 30 different countries around the world. And so I was able to take the experiences in Europe, and there's always a fear about going, well, how are you ever going to, penetrate Canada? I mean, they got a big, well, look, we did it in Britain, we did it in Germany, and Canada's on our doorstep. It's a lot easier. You fly people up and down. And then you start looking at the geography, and Toronto was closer than Washington. But, people just didn't think in those terms. And 81 just went right from Allentown to Montreal. So
it's like you were talking about in Europe.
Yeah.
The European countries.
Oh, yeah.
They're
at
it.
He's an hour away. Yeah. But it just seems spread out and diversified and so forth. So I did that, and then ran all of our gas businesses. And then Ed was selected to succeed Leonard, and I followed Ed as president, and I picked up the chemical business, and then decided, then we had an engineering and construction business, and there was this major thrust into the synfuels area, and we didn't feel we had enough engineering capability, and Ed made the decision to acquire an expanded capability in Stearns Roger, and we did that, and then that greatly increased our engineering capability, and we went after some of these major synfuel contracts with the government. We had a good concept of looking to the government as a means of developing emerging new technologies for government use, but technology that had a large potential commercial market application. That had been the story about oxygen plants, that had been the story about our helium recovery program, it was a story about liquid hydrogen, the space program, had been our involvement in providing liquid oxygen to the intermediate range rockets when we were confronting Russia with the Minuteman program. And so in every case, those projects and programs that we had built for the federal government served us very well in strengthening our relationships in going after key commercial markets. Carbide took a different tack. They didn't like dealing with governments. They were a burden. They were regulatory. They were administrative difficult. But we said, look, here's a way to get your research funded and your engineering, get experience, and build manufacturing capabilities. And yeah, we'll put up with all those burdensome mechanistic dealings in order to expand our markets and to develop our technologies. And so we just took advantage of the needs of the government, provided those needs could be demonstrated to have potential application to the commercial market. And then we could be the instrument for taking that technology into the marketplace. And, so we've been a good example of the benefits of just like, you know, Boeing developed the jetliner out of their tanker program for the government. So we developed the liquid hydrogen business, which is where we dominate that market today, because of our involvement in the space program.
I'm not sure how much more time you have available.
Well, what are some of the key questions that you want to make sure you get answered here?
There was one thing in particular. 1986, Donnelly turned the company over to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you set out on your 10-year plan.
Plan, right.
Mm-hmm. The one aspect of that that I wanted to sort of focus on here comes from this committee on innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite intrigued, and that's one of the things we're trying to do is look at innovation in mm-hmm. chemical industry.
Yeah, right.
First of all, what does innovation mean to you and your experience with it?
Well, you know, I guess I've developed my thinking about that. I have a view that wealth is created through the introduction of new products, processes, and technologies which lower costs, reduce the consumption of materials, improve the benefit to the customers. And that as engineers, manufacturers particularly, that we are the wealth creators of the country. It's only through innovation that wealth is created. I mean, the steam engine replaced the horse-drawn, the 747 that replaces the 707, the PC that replaces the big blue box, the cellular telephone, the satellite, every innovation that expands markets, reduces costs, makes things cheaper, uses less materials, less energy, that increases wealth. And then the role of the manufacturer is to divide up, if you will, the benefits of that innovation between the consumer and the producer. And so my view is that innovation and creativity and technological advances are the fundamental driving forces that create economic well-being for society. And that those societies that focus on those things broadly are the ones that progress and develop. Those companies that do it, those divisions within companies. And I think if you look that through, you'll find that that is a truism, that the wealth of nations is no longer a function of raw materials or of access or natural resources. It's a function of their ability to innovate, to take advantage of those things, but raw materials, minerals are readily available to everybody. And it was particularly important to Air Products because we started with no advantages, just air, and everybody had access to air.